Yesterday at a work circle, Chris mentioned this quote from the Ehe Kodoku, Dogen said. And the quote, I wrote it down, is simply hold each other's hands. Visit the Buddha Hall, the meditation hall. Simply hold each other's hands. Visit the Buddha Hall. And wholeheartedly give ourselves to everyday practice. Couldn't get simpler than that. To simply hold each other's hands. To express in that simple gesture the connection with all beings, since each being includes all beings, includes all of life. So simply touch that.
What was the last part of the quote?
I'm going to get there. I'll get there.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. And then to visit the Buddha Hall, the Zendo. The character is literally a Zendo. Zen is meditation. Do is both the place and the way. So to be in touch with all beings and go to the place and the way of Zen, of meditation. It's a building, of course, but also it's just ourself. There is no place or way of the Buddha way outside of ourselves. We shouldn't think it's in some other special place. It's in the place where we take hands with our friends, with our beings, with all beings. And in that way, to wholeheartedly give ourselves to everyday practice. That is everyday practice. To take our place with all beings. To hold all beings in our hands. To know that all beings are in our hands. To sit in that way. To practice in that way. To realize the mind of that way. By giving ourselves to everything we encounter, which is our everyday practice. That's the whole thing just right there. Couldn't be more simply stated. When Maizumi Roshi, the founder of another Zen pioneer who came from Japan along with Suzuki Roshi, when he talked about all of Dogen's teachings in Shobogenzo, you know, that enormous work, he said that came down to appreciate your life. All of that language, when Kazuna translated it, 500,000 English words. I think 1,600 pages, 250-page glossary. Appreciate your life. And Dogen is saying, here's how you appreciate your life. Simply hold each other's hands. Visit the Buddha Hall. And wholeheartedly give ourselves to everyday practice. And you won't have to wonder about appreciating your life. You will be appreciating your life because you'll be expressing your life. So we have a very simple way to do it. And I like very much the idea of uncluttering Buddhist teachings, uncluttering Buddhist terminology, uncluttering this incredibly rich, beautiful tapestry of teachings that has been handed down to us for so many centuries. And I think it's important to do it because both ancient teachings and because they're based on ancient teachings, and because we're trying to say what can't really be said and understand what really can't be understood in the way that we think of understanding, as I was talking about the other day. I'm trying to say what I can't say, and you're trying to hear what I can't say and what you can't hear. All of this is going on. I think maybe it's a good idea to unclutter some unclutter some of that, because we are just ordinary people. And it turns out that that's sufficient. You know, both the ancient and contemporary or modern teachings can sound so difficult, so impossible really to grasp. We get lost kind of wandering around, noodling in our head, trying to figure out, you know, is there something that I need to obtain or to attain or to know or to realize in order to be my whole Buddha self? Do I really have to kind of go to like Buddha college or something like that, you know, and pass the test? And at the same time, the teachings say there's nothing to attain. So your head just kind of spins around in this absurd kind of whirlpool. But fortunately, as I hope you heard, Suzuki Roshi and other great teachers have told us that we should try to remember that in reality there isn't anything to attain. There's nothing to grasp. There's nothing to get. And of course, you know, I gratefully and quite humbly agree with that. What did you learn at your retreat? Simply hold each other's hands. Don't forget to go to the Buddha Hall and wholeheartedly give yourself to everyday practice. You know, with all these teachings, it sounds so... What is the word? I'm not going to get the word. I don't know, specialized, institutionalized. And then on top of that, we have these lives that are so busy, and it's so crazy, there's so many demands, so many things coming at us all the time, constantly. It's almost like we don't get to live our lives, we just get to fend off to get to the next thing that we have to fend off. So we can get to the next thing that we have to fend off, and then drop into bed at night and try to get some rest so we can wake up in the morning and fend something else off. It's a kind of crazy way of living. And every once in a while, of course, we have a moment where we remember that we are really so miraculous as beings. These beings are just so incredible. They're so miraculous. Don't you think? You really just stop for a moment. The miracle of this existence. You know, we're born with these wonderful bodies. We're born with these lovely minds, these good minds, these good hearts, these untarnished, pure minds. Untarnished, pure hearts. Not fending off. Hearts and minds that are just completely and open and eager and curious and wanting to take the world in as it comes to us. That's how we're born, with the same kind of appetite to be nourished by it that we have for physical nourishment. I mean, you know, we have babies born that want nourishment. And the mind is born and it wants nourishment. It wants to take the world in. It doesn't want to fend it off. And if you... Shirley and I have a new grandniece, and our dear niece and nephew have been sending little videos of the little baby, and they put a mobile, you know, a little mobile above it, And the baby looks up at the mother and just goes, just wiggles. Look at that. It's just a little kind of thing over its head, you know. But that's the way our minds work. We want that. We want to take it in. And when we see a baby like that, we remember for a moment, yeah, that's me. That's me. What's that? Wow. We think there's wow somewhere else after we do something. This is all wow. There's no non-wow. And we used to know that. And the truth is that even with all the fending off that we do, when life comes as it comes and meets us in its own terms, the truth is that we still can meet and maintain life and maintain this whole pure-mindedness. Because in fact, just like our Buddha nature, it's always here. And we can sustain those minds that are open and clear and excited and curious and filled with insight and just with a great appetite to touch everything that comes in front of us without fending off, without pushing back from it, but in a way that's insightful and useful as we grow and we learn the use of insight and the use of being useful or having useful minds in the world. And I think that also we know that it's not just that way, that we also can develop some problems. We can develop some kind of troubles in our mind. And we have friends and family members and it isn't just one way, right? It isn't just one side. When I was a boy, I was very lucky. I was introduced to playing music at a very early age. It seemed that I was musical, and so they thought, well, let's teach them some music. So the first thing they did is they got me an accordion, but I was so little that I couldn't hold it. So I failed immediately. Thank goodness. I was this little sickly child, and they gave me this big thing. Just get this off of me. It's like they bought me an anvil and expected me to be happy about it. Here's a little anvil. We know you can't sit up in bed, but why don't you carry this around for a while? So I failed, and that was the first sign that maybe they should do something else, because they were attentive parents. So I started playing guitar when I was about 8, and and learning the kind of songs that were around me at the time, which are classically known as kind of folk songs, and in my also my background. So also we didn't just sing folk songs; we sang union hymns, sang socialist labor songs. You can't scare me, I'm sticking with the union. Till the day I die. Turns out that was true. And of course I was 8, but I sang it with all my heart. One of the songs that I loved to sing by the time I was 10 was Trouble in Mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always, 'cause the sun's gonna shine in my back door someday. Mm-hmm. I'm 10 years old. My mother's hearing me sing this old black blues song. She's thinking, oh, if only he had played the accordion. I wouldn't have this soulful boy singing his heart out about his troubled mind. He's only 10. But I sang it with all my heart. But clearly we all know that we may have trouble in our minds. We may get very complicated, but there is some confidence even in that song I sang starting when I was 10 years old, that thanks to impermanence, it is possible for trouble to change, to go away. And if you think about our Zen practice in the root of it, the idea that we can help bring suffering to an end for ourselves and for others, that's something we just seem to know. There's no guarantee that it will happen, but we have a way for that to happen. And when I thought about that song, which I've always loved, ever since I first learned it, that phrase, "the sun's going to shine in my back door someday," I thought, that's a very important teaching. That's a good teaching. I think sometimes people think that when there's some kind of, you know, we practice Zen, there's some kind of enlightenment experience or some kind of realization, that it's just, you know, such a total blast off that the sun is just going to knock the front door down and just going to shine right through the front door, and it's going to just fill the house. It's going to stream in through the windows, and it's always going to be that way. It's never going to change. For some reason, impermanence is true about everything but enlightenment experiences, and that's going to be it. We're going to stand at the sink, and the light's going to pour out of the faucet and wash our dishes for us. And, you know, and in fact, now I'm remembering one of the songs we used to sing, because I went to something that we effectively called commie camp. We used to sing was about Oleana. Let's see. In Oleana, land is free. The milk and corn just plant themselves. The something in corn plants themselves. The cows all like to milk themselves while on our beds we rest ourselves. Ole, Oleana, ole, Oleana. Ole, 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 ole. You can imagine how shocked we little commie kids were when we discovered we lived in a capitalist society. Things didn't just take care of themselves. It actually was good. We had to work. Mm-hmm. Work was the best thing. So I think you'll agree that the idea that, you know, you have some kind of major realization experience, it just blows the front door out, and that's it. It's going to stay like that forever. That's like a special effects of a kind of Buddhist sci-fi movie. It might be overstating the case a little bit, because it turns out that in order to get the dishes clean, A, you need a dish, B, you need some soap, C, you need some water, and D, you need to wash the dish, even after this kind of experience. So what I want to say is that because there's so much focus, and you know, Roshi was talking about enlightenment, which he didn't usually talk about, you know, it may come through the front door. It's possible. It could come through the front door as a kind of experience that we have. And many of you had a kind of experience like, wow, what's that? And we can be totally aware of it as some kind of experience. But it's not necessarily a front door experience. It's something that you really need to know. That's a kind of romanticization that has come through Zen literature. And it's possible, it can be fireworks. If there's some kind of particular moment where something is realized or something very big happens, that's true, that can happen. But even if that's the case, I think that as we live our lives, we find that the kind of realization that we can really be immersed in, that moves through us, that, as Roshi said, that saturates us, right? The brown rice saturates our whole body, saturates our whole being. It's a more subtle kind of thing. And it's one of the reasons that developing that sort of subtle awareness in our meditation is so important. It's really important to develop that subtle sense of the breath. Is the breath coarse? Is it more fine? Is it a little more refined? What is it exactly? You know, it's often found in a more quiet part of ourselves. that kind of realization, where we just suddenly, oh, rather than wow, just like, oh, I never saw that before. Oh, I get it. Or if we're in Zazen, it could be a sort of very nuanced gesture or movement of the heart or the mind, where suddenly things are a little different. And that difference makes all the difference in the world. It can be that subtle, that gentle, that quiet. And Maizumi Roshi called it the hazy moon of enlightenment, mm-hmm. which I think is a great phrase. Mm-hmm. More like a hazy moon, right? Not a Klieg light, you know, like a Hollywood opening. More like a hazy moon. And I think it's a really good phrase. And, you know, when it comes, you know, it often slips through the back door. Mm-hmm. It slips through the back door where we're not looking as we cultivate our practice and we live a life of practice, as Suzuki Roshi was suggesting that we do. So maybe one way to think about our practice, and it's a little dangerous for me to say like this, but, you know, we've been practicing, so I know I can trust you with it. We can think of our practice as a backdoor key, right? It's what helps to open the back door. You know, unless, of course, we think, oh, it's a backdoor key. So then we turn our practice into some kind of utilitarian thing that says, oh, that's going to open the back door. Then that's still front door expectation. You know? That's not quite right. But if we just recognize that one of the possible collateral I don't know what the word is that I want to use. Maybe facts is good enough. Is that it helps the back door to open so that this subtle thing can start to be experienced in our lives. That's really what I'm talking about. We should have some confidence that, you know, if we practice, because that's simply what we do, not for any purpose, except to express our nature. You know, that if we practice without any expectation of any kind, but just doing what we're doing because that's what we're doing, that's a kind of backdoor practice. That's what I'm talking about. And over time, you know, backdoor practice has this marvelous, this truly wonderful way of helping us to recognize that what we talk about as true self or original self or Buddha self is really just right here in this ordinary self, this ordinary, astoundingly miraculous daily self, just right here. And it comes in the back door, where we suddenly can feel alive and say, oh, my goodness. Or we suddenly can see the leaves, suddenly can feel the wind, oh, my goodness. This really is the whole thing. I was just, before coming in, I was looking at my window and, you know, there's kind of leaves dying on them. There was one branch sticking straight up and it was holding the dying leaves up. In the shimmering light, this kind of orange-yellow shine as the sun met the leaves. And it was almost holding it like a torch in the middle of the day. That, wow, there it is, right there. You want to know about the great matter of birth and death? There it is. The tree is holding up as a torch for everyone to see. And the sunlight is coming down to make sure I see it. And my eyes are in the leaves. And the leaves are in my eyes. And we are all doing this together. And it was so quiet. It was just so beautiful. You know, it's part of this idea of, you know, this backdoor practice. It's part of why in Zen we say that we should take the backward step and let our inner light shine within. Not the forward step. The backward step. The backward step is when you sit down, you breathe in. And then back into the self, back into this experience of life itself, taking the backward step. When that happens, it allows us to enter what is talked about in Christian teachings as the cloud of unknowing. Any of you know that phrase? The cloud of unknowing. It's an incredible phrase. Not the cloud of knowing. Not the cloud of getting, attaining, obtaining, possessing. The cloud of unknowing. Maybe we even have to unknow what we think we know so we can just be in the cloud of unknowing. Not holding on to any idea. Not holding on to any preconception. Nothing. Just the hazy moon, the cloud of unknowing. Can you hear the orientation of those phrases? Hazy moon, cloud of unknowing. It's all back door. It's all back door. When Roshi Bernie Glassman, who was Mizumi Roshi's Dharma heir, Bernie died last year. Very dear. Sweet guy. He really took Zen to the streets in a way that, you know, nobody else really has. He put it out there. He actually disrobed as a priest and said, "I'm just a householder like everybody." And he started the Greystone Bakery, and he started street retreats, and he started feeding people. He started teaching homeless and people or people who had been in jail how to work, how to hold jobs, how to meet a schedule, how to feed themselves. He just put it out there. He took many of us to Auschwitz so we could sit in the middle of hell and try to understand what is hell in these terms, so our bodhisattva nature could rise and make sure that we could understand something of use to the world. He came up with, he started something called the Zen Peacemakers Order. And they have three tenets. The first one is not knowing, like the cloud of unknowing, simply not knowing. And the second one is, in the mind of not knowing, just bearing witness to what's there. And then the third one is having the confidence that by not knowing and simply bearing witness, a loving action will arise to take care of the situation in front of you. Not because of good or bad, but because if we simply not know and we simply bear witness, we will naturally step forward because we are natural bodhisattvas. That was Bernie's understanding of our nature, part of what we mean by Buddha nature. We just will. We just will. Not everybody, but that's the level of the damage in that person. That's how hurt they are. But many people will. And even the most hurt person might have some inclination in that direction. It can't be held back completely. And when we have the practice of not knowing, which is zazen, and simply bearing witness to what takes place in that vast sky of the mind, and finding the inclination toward connection is another way to talk about loving action. You know, beneficial action or a benevolent action. That's very much another way of talking about what is called samadhi practice in Zen. That's the mind of samadhi, that broad, bright, empty, but in touch mind. So maybe what I can say is that we may not see the Buddha living in the front of the house until she comes through the back door and starts to live in the back of the house for a little while. We may not know who's living in the back of the house. There may be somebody in the back of the house. Open the door. It's the exact opposite of everything we're told. There may be someone in the back of your house. What should I do? Open the door. You know, of course, you know, the Buddha is the house. And the Buddha is the whole house. But through the cultivation of our practice, we can meet her at the back door And then invite her in and say, oh, look, this is where I'm living. Mm-hmm. Come on in. I think that one way to talk about it is, it comes from the poet Charles Olson. He had a wonderful phrase talking about how poetry comes about sometimes. He said, we do what we know before we know what we do. That's backdoor practice. Suddenly, we're doing what we, quote, know, but know not just with the mind. Know with the whole being. Before we even know that we're doing it. And as Suzuki Roshi said, you know, learning to trust ourselves and learning to have a practice that helps us to become one with our intuition, we can call it, you know, that helps us to do what we know before we know what we do, beyond any judgment. We're just doing it. We're jumping to life. We're actualizing our life. We're actualizing our whole being 100% by the action we're taking because of not knowing and because of bearing witness. It can be found right here. And it's cultivated in our practice. I know that I've told you the story of once when I was driving with Shirley and someone cut me off in traffic. And I had an instant reactive impulse to speed up. It's not like I thought, oh, someone cut me off in practice. I think what I want to do is speed up. I just, my body went boom, and my foot started to go for the accelerator. And it was such a powerful reactive impulse. And I think if you look honestly at yourselves, you'll admit you have many powerful reactive impulses that just come like that. It was so powerful, Shirley could feel it. I didn't say, hey, that guy cut me off in traffic. She could feel how strong it was. That's how strong my reactivity was in that moment. And so she just said to me, Peter, you're a Buddhist. Remember your vows. And the Buddha took my foot off the accelerator. I didn't. The Buddha did. Because the Buddha was in the back of the house. He said, hey, I don't want you to drive the house into that car. And I don't want you to get into... It wasn't called road rage in those days. It was just called being an asshole. You know, I don't want you to be that kind of person. But hearing, right? Remember your vows. Just instantly changed the whole situation. Because they've been cultivated in the back of the house. She didn't have to explain it to me. Peter, you're a Buddhist. Remember, you took vows. You don't want to do this. It grows inside of us. It gets very big inside of us. And all we have to do is hear it. So maybe a good thing to do is to post, a little post-it on the door jamb by the back door. Remember your vows. Remember your intention. Remember what you want your life and all life to be. Remember what you want for the world. Don't forget that. Remember, that's another way to say remember your vows. You know, the Dalai Lama also had a, you know, situation. Someone asked him if he ever had any sexual kind of thoughts or inclinations or confusion or, you know, anything like that. And he said, oh, yes. Once. He said, I was dreaming. And I had some kind of, I love his voice, I had some kind of sexual content. But then somebody showed up and said, you're a monk. So my problem went away right away. Just like that. But actually, that's true. Right? Remember your vows. It's not that there was something wrong with sexual content. It's that he had made a decision about how he wanted to live his life. So the Buddha came running from the back of the house, even though the Dalai Lama was sleeping, and said, psst.
And gave a fire extinguisher. Yeah.
Suzuki Roshi talked about being a Buddhist. And we can ask ourselves, what does it mean to say I'm a Buddhist? Or I practice the Buddha way. What does it really mean for us? And I think one of the things it means is that we we make a determination, we make a commitment to keep our vows and precepts, our aspirations, our intention to live as one with all beings, as very warm companions. Not as not as anything more than that. Just as like a companion of our heart and mind. So we can remember, like a good friend. You know, not a kind of rule, but a good friend. You know, that we want to help us live our lives. We keep them close and we study. We study our precepts, we study our vows, we study our intention, we study our aspirations to live a certain way as part of our study of ourselves, because they don't come from outside. You know, we take the precepts and vows, those of us who do within Zen, but they don't come from outside. They're articulated in a way, but they're not from outside of us. So we study them and we try to find the source of them in ourselves. And we can ask, where do they come from in ourselves? What is the root of this aspiration? What is the root of these precepts or these vows, as we say them? And very importantly, why in our tradition, in Zen tradition, why do we say that the mind of Zazen is the precepts? Just let that come in a little bit. Why is the mind of Zazen the whole of the Bodhisattva precepts and vows? Why is it the whole of what's articulated in those precepts and those vows? What is it about the mind of Zazen that is precepts? Let's kind of absorb that a little bit. What is it we settle into that is the ground of precepts, that is the root of them, that is the foundation of that? That is the unobstructed source of those precepts and vows that are articulated and written down. You know, Zen practitioners, we often place a focus on these words, you know, on, you know, Buddha nature. We focus on enlightenment, we focus on true nature. But it's pretty hard, I think, for people to say in any useful way exactly what they are. You know, we talk about them. They're like a mystery novel. You know, we want to kind of solve the problem. We read the novel. We read the words, you know, Buddha nature, enlightenment, true nature, original self. And then we try to solve the mystery of what that is. You know, we try to stick our minds into the mystery and solve it before we get to the end of the book. We want to know what it is before we die. What are you going to do with it after you die? It's not about finding it out at the end of the book. But, you know, it's like sticking our hands into a cloud and expecting them to come out holding something. You know, that's not more cloud. You know, we grasp for the idea or the concept of what these things are, or we, you know, we try to figure out a way to say it, to express it in some way, to express the inexpressible. But the more we grasp and seek and push with that kind of mind, it's a very kind of front door expectation mind, right? I'm going to get it. I'm going to get the brass ring. The more we just shove it further into the cloud, we just push it further and further away. So it's not an upaya, you know, it's not a skillful means of making things work. So I'm thinking about uncluttering. I'm thinking about what's a really more practical way, a kind of simpler way that we can follow, that we can find. You know, just right here in these miraculous, ordinary selves that we are. And I've come to think of it as just simply the practice of a kind heart. just a kind heart, not more than that. And we can actually develop this practice of a kind heart by letting a kind heart help us to study the self, study what we are, by cultivating the kind of habit that sees, just a habit that sees with a kind and kind of loving eyes, you know, Buddha's eyes. Eyes that are not interested in looking at us or looking at the world or looking at things with a kind of grasping, attaining, obtaining, judgmental, preconceived mind. A different kind of mind. Because when we're grasping and we're seeking to attain and we're judgmental and we have a lot of preconceptions about things, we actually don't have any way to touch them. All of those things are in the way. So we're trying to find out what things are and creating the obstructions to the intimacy that it takes to know what things are, including ourselves. But if we establish a kind of intention, just start with an intention or a kind of aspiration to take the world in with kind of kind and loving eyes. Just like the baby wants to take in that, you know, Juliana wants to take in that mobile. She wants to eat it. She wants to become with it. You know, that's a different thing. And if you think about it, these kind of eyes that I'm talking about, seeing with those kind of eyes that are rooted in a kind heart, these are, in fact, the same eyes that the precepts and the vows have. They are the same lens. They rest on the same ground. You know, I'm talking about precepts and vows because six people here are going to receive their Bodhisattva precepts and vows in about, I don't know when, 2 weeks or a little less than 2 weeks. And so this talk, this part of the talk is for them, but actually it's for all of us. And it's, even if you are just brand new here and never even heard of Bodhisattva precepts and vows, it doesn't matter. You have your precepts and vows. They're in you. They're, at the very least, the seed is there, but probably they're awake in you, which is one of the reasons you came to practice. So we all have them. You know, when we see with these eyes, we can understand that these are the same eyes as the eyes of the precepts. Because these are the eyes that wouldn't let us lie or kill or steal. They wouldn't let us misuse the life forces that are part of our relational nature. Kind and caring eyes don't do that. They don't go around creating mayhem, wherever they go. Those are the precepts' eyes. They don't let us be led around by the kind of reactive mind habit and impulse that I experienced when that person, you know, sped up in front of me in traffic for very long. They show up quickly, especially when they're cultivated. You know, when the Buddha took my foot off the accelerator, that was the precepts functioning. They function because the eyes are there in the back of the head. And so it's important for us to continue to cultivate a practice that allows that to happen very quickly. It doesn't keep the impulse from happening all the time, but it can catch it really quickly if we make that kind of a heart our intention. You know, when we practice and we cultivate seeing ourselves and others, with these eyes, we're simultaneously cultivating the heart. You know, the kindness of the heart that knows, to speak about another precepts, don't go talking about yourself in a way that makes sure that the other person feels diminished and you feel taller. You know the phrase, a drowning person can never be tall enough? Anytime you find yourself putting somebody down so you can feel above them, It's because you're drowning. Mm-hmm. And you don't know it. So you're pushing them down. When we see with those eyes, we won't do that. You know. And as soon as we do see with those eyes, we feel a little sorry that we did it. So we know we don't want to do it. Oh, I didn't have to talk that way. You know, these are the eyes that help us remember that instead of causing harm, we want to avoid harm. Instead of creating destruction wherever we go, we actually want to live as the wholehearted beings in touch with everything that we truly are. Because we do really treasure life. We treasure it bringing some goodness into the world. We treasure the ability to actually help somebody else. It feels good. And beyond how it feels, we know that it's necessary. Like I felt very happy after yoga. I've said this before, but I'm kind of yoga phobic. I'm really scared to loosen up. Because my body is made in agreement. Everything knows exactly how to keep the stasis of the inability to move in place. So it's really scared. Like some of you, it's your mind. With me, it's my body. It's really scared to take a chance. So after we did yoga yesterday, which I survived, I was actually very happy to do it. And fortunately, Melanie and Joel picked me up off the ground. Floor. And I thought, boy, Sattva's here because I can't get up. You know, these eyes that I'm talking about, these are bodhisattva eyes, of course. You know, these are Buddha's eyes. They're our eyes. And then, you know, like, what is that, Rod Stewart? The Betty Davis eyes. You know, these are human eyes. This is us. But this practice is very important. And it's another form of practice realization. You know, Dogen's phrase, practice realization. Not practicing to become realized, but practicing because we are realized. Practice as an expression of our realized nature, of our enlightened nature. You know, the practice of the kind heart is another form of practice realization. We don't have to wait to become enlightened to be kind. A kind heart is an enlightened heart. A kind heart is a realized heart in action. It's already taking place. And the thing that's amazing about it is the more we allow ourselves to do it and get those obstructions out of the way, the more we practice the kind heart practice, the more it cultivates a realization in other parts of our lives. We may not see it at first because it's happening by the back door. But it spreads. You know, I'm sure you know, any of you who have ever taken part in a conversation that you wished you hadn't been dragged into, where a lot of negativity is being spoken about somebody else maybe, you know how quickly that poison spreads through you, don't you? How awful it feels. Because you really just don't want to be doing that. And yet, you've been exposed to it, and it spreads quickly. It's like a drop of, you know, ink on a watery page. It goes. But the same is true with realization practice. In the opposite direction. The simplest of realization practice is like a kind heart. Spreads through your whole body mind and changes us. And to make a determination to practice in that way, I think, is not a bad thing at all. I know that it may seem hard when we think about it. Maybe can we do it or not? You know, excuse me. So that, you know, our Buddha mind, our realized mind, our whole being mind, you know, the precepts and the vows, and, you know, everything can just flow through the back door. But, you know, all it really takes to start is to make a determination to lead and to always return when we forget to a kind heart. That's an uncluttered teaching. We know we have obstructions. I have made a determination that I will lead with a kind heart. I will return to a kind heart. That's all. Not more than that. No, we can start to practice it, and we can start to cultivate it in Zazen in the very next period, just by simply noticing our relationship to both the kindness and the unkindness in our own hearts and minds. We don't have to go searching for, some kind of research place. We don't need a research grant. All we have to do is sit down at Zazen. Notice how our mind is treating us. Make a determination that that can change if it's treating us in an unkind way. That's all. Notice the inclination to be kind or unkind to ourselves. Whatever we notice in our Zazen about kindness or unkindness, the kind of voice we hear, the kind of orientation we have, the kind of attitude we have, even just in sitting Zazen, that's what we're putting into the world. So we may have kind of great kindness to offer, and we may have unkindness that's going out into the world. So we can study it right there, and that's the beginning. That's the beginning of strengthening the practice of the kind heart right there in Zazen every day. How am I doing? You can see. Make a determination. Lead. Return. Lead. Because we forget. And return. So, when you hear me say the words kind heart, you know, I think it's fair to say, okay, what am I really talking about? What does it look like? You know, what kind of things does a kind heart do? How does it act? What does it make possible? Before talking personally, I just want to point out that a kind heart is a heart that's at the root of what's called the four Brahma Viharas in Buddhism. The Brahma Viharas are infinite abodes. They're states of mind that are infinite. There's no end to them. And you've heard some of the words, or maybe you know them. It's metta, karuna, mudita, and upetka. Metta is loving kindness. Kind heart is at the root of loving kindness. That seems obvious, doesn't it? And then there's karuna, compassion. Kind heart is at the root of karuna. It's at the root of compassion. And then there's mudita. Mudita is a kind of sympathetic or appreciative or benevolent joy, participating in the lives of others. So when something nice happens for someone, or, you know, someone is feeling love, or, you know, maybe they get a splinter out of their toe or something, you feel a kind of sympathetic, appreciative joy in the life of that other being. You become one with them through that practice of mudita. I used to do this practice after I was divorced many years ago. I just couldn't get up in the morning and cook for myself, so I'd go to this outdoor stand and they would make me an egg sandwich, and I was not happy because I had just been through this stupid kind of gratuitous, I mean, it's to get divorced is one thing, but to do it stupidly is, you know, stupid. But in order to help myself, what I would do is I would get a cup of coffee and I'd get an egg sandwich, and, you know, Maury and Steve would make it come in, they'd see me come in, they'd have my sandwich ready, and I'd sit down and I'd lift my sandwich up, and my practice was I would look up, and whoever my eyes fell on, I would find something to be joyful about in them. And before I took my first bite, I would practice mudita. I would practice bonding with the joy in them and being happy for them, even though I was so miserable. And then I would eat my food. So you can actually come up with kind of practices like that. And the fourth of the infinite abodes is in the Brahma Viharas is upekkha, which is equanimity. And if you look deeply at what equanimity can mean, you'll find a kind heart is at the root of it. It's right down there in the source place of it. So, do you have your writing materials with you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hope you do. No? If you don't, go get them. Because I'm going to pull the study in that direction now. So, yeah, please go quickly. And we have time. And those of you who are here, what I'm going to ask you to do is write down the words, a kind heart. That's all, just a kind heart. And we're going to complete the sentence from a certain kind of perspective. Yeah, if someone needs paper, then you can give them your paper. Okay, you there? Anybody need? Shirley needs paper. Shirley, remember your vows. Where's your paper? You know. Okay, so write down the words a kind heart. And I'm going to ask you to complete the sentence from a certain perspective. From when we think about a kind heart, because of the context in which this teaching is taking place, we think about it from a Buddhist or a Zazen practice perspective. I'm going to give you some examples of what I mean first, but I'm going to ask you to write down three ways that a kind heart can manifest. So, for example, thinking of my practice, my Buddhist practice, my Zen practice. These are ways to complete the sentence for myself. This is what I wrote down. So, a kind heart lets go. A kind heart listens. A kind heart bears witness in silence before it speaks or acts. A kind heart assumes oneness, sees self and other as not other. A kind heart maintains the intention to act based on oneness, even when withdrawing, contracting. A kind heart trusts that deep intuition as an act of kindness to itself and knows that it can always improve. And so a kind heart is humble, it's modest, it's in touch. It notices the ego's demand to dominate and responds to it with a kind heart. That's called taking your foot off the accelerator. A kind heart helps the frightened self in self and others. Does not take advantage. And a kind heart mostly studies itself with honesty and a desire to know how to be fully kind. So these are some, you know, I wrote these down fairly quickly. These are just sitting in my practice. What is a kind heart? So I'm going to ask you to sit for a minute, take some breaths, settle into your breath, settle into yourself, and you can allow your kind heart maybe to surprise you with what comes to you, and you should trust what's given to you. How does it act? What does a kind heart do? And what does a kind heart make possible? So out of the swirl of words I just used, just sit for a minute quietly and see what comes to you. We'll do it for, you know, fairly quickly. Write down three. Rather than writing with your mind, write with your breath. Trust what comes into your mind from your breathing to be what your kind heart wants you to know right now. Just be some short things, no big deal, no dissertations. It's like calling a kind heart and saying, I have a question for you. Who are you? Mm-hmm. And the kind heart says, no, no. Who are you? Mm-hmm. Let me tell you. Just, you know, one more minute. Don't judge yourself while you're doing it. Just be kind. Okay. If you have at least one, that's a good thing. So obviously we don't have time for everyone to read everything. But can we hear a couple? Does anyone mind? Maybe say one and let's then pass the baton to someone else. Anyone feel like doing it? Yeah, just do it.
Share it freely.
Pardon?
Share it freely.
A kind heart. Yeah, let's start with a kind heart shares freely. Yeah, good.
Yeah, kind heart feel and is attentive.
Feels?
And is attentive.
And is attentive. Uh-huh. Mm, yeah, great.
Kind heart has no expectations.
Mm-hmm. Kind heart has no expectations. Wow, can you imagine how relieved you'd feel?
Yeah. A kind heart is authentic.
Mm-hmm.
A kind heart isn't scoring points, but lets all sides be a winner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not point scoring. Right? Just lets all sides be aware, you say, right?
A winner.
A winner. All sides. Yeah.
Kind heart understands everyone is doing the only thing possible for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm. That's a part of equanimity, by the way. Accepting. that you may not be able to change what the other person is doing. Making room for them. It's rooted in a kind heart. It's one of the hardest things for us to accept as part of equanimity. Mm-hmm. But it is in fact true. Yeah.
Kind heart has lots of room for self and others.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you to say it again and don't sound like a question at the end?
A kind heart has lots of room for self and others.
That's right. It certainly does. No question about that. Yeah. More?
A kind heart knows who it is.
Yeah.
A kind heart sees another kind heart, even if the actions don't look like a kind heart.
We know a lot about a kind heart, don't we? Yeah.
A kind heart feels and sees beyond the surface frictions in relationships to the Buddha's within.
Mm-hmm. Kind heart sees the Buddha, right? Beyond conditions.
A kind heart offers the best seat.
Yeah.
A kind heart is an open palm.
A kind heart turns toward pain with tenderness rather than a desire to kill it.
A kind heart makes soup for everyone.
That's a lot of soup. That's for sure. Louder, please.
A kind heart is simply giving someone your face. Holding.
Anyone else?
A kind heart is non-doing love.
Is?
Non-doing love.
Non-doing love. Yeah.
This is something you told me, Peter, that has stuck with me for 15 years.
Was
kind
what?
A kind heart saves all beings.
Breath by breath. Deed by deed. Thought by thought. Moment by moment. It doesn't have a big brush, it has a little brush. But it paints.
Big canvases.
Yeah.
A kind heart saves tears to water hope.
A kind heart makes it easier to live with ourselves.
A kind heart finds out how a burden can be a treasure. Thank you. I did some, did I cut someone off? Did someone have anything else they want to add? How do you feel listening to this?
What was that?
No one feels anything? I did some research in the dictionary. I've always liked to look things up in the book. When I grew up in New York City, we had, you know, five boroughs, a lot of people living there, so there were, you know, like 8 million names in the phone books. And I used to look up all the Levitts, because I wanted to make sure that I was really alive. I would say, oh, there's another one. Oh, yeah, there's another one. Somehow it meant something to me, like I'm actually here. I wasn't really sure I was actually here, but then when I saw other people with my name, I thought, "Oh, I must actually be here." And I would wonder about them, and you know. So I've always researched these. My mother said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm looking up Levitts." She said, "You did that yesterday." I said, "There may be new ones." She said, "Not in the book." I just wasn't sure I really existed. So when I looked up the etymology of the word "kind," it's very interesting to me. It comes from the Old English, kind or gekind, which has Germanic origin. And it's related, you won't be surprised, to the word kin, which appears in the Old English as kin or sin, related to the Dutch word kun. This really was exciting, which comes from the Indo-European root, which means to give birth to. Let that come in, right? Kind comes from the Indo-European root, which means to give birth to. We can ask, what does a kind heart give birth to? That's what I just asked you. It's also related to the Greek genos and the Latin genus, which means a kind of like a class or group with certain characteristics, or kind of like a race. We can use that in terms of human beings. And the original sense of kind was nature, or native, or of the natural order. Isn't this interesting? Like of the natural kind. Order. Pardon?
Like animal kind. Or
like animal kind. Yeah, right, that's right. Also, an innate characteristic form or condition. Something innate. So we have a kind of class or race with natural, as part of its natural order, has innate characteristics. And in one of my sources, it said, a class or race distinguished by innate characteristics. So we can say kindness is a kind of natural, innate characteristic. That's how human beings have understood this for a long time. By the time the word reached Middle English, the earliest the usage and the earliest sense of the word kind in Middle English was someone who was by nature gentle and benevolent. The by nature was very important. It was not learned. Mm. Right? Someone who was naturally gentle or benevolent. So if we kind of put it all together, we can say it's a kind of, say, class or a race distinguished by natural innate characteristics that include gentleness and benevolence. That's us. That's us. Does it surprise you? The part about giving birth to at its root, or the fact that it's about a sort of innate, natural characteristic of our being.
Surprising that why now in our system, kind heart seems to be a sign of weakness.
Because we have a culture of domination. Right? We have a culture of domination. And so there's no room for it. Right? It should be squashed. You know, you're not going to get to eat all the other dogs if you're kind, so don't be kind, eat those dogs. Right. It's against our cultural value. I think you know, I'm sure almost all of you have heard of the writer Aldous Huxley, who's a writer that I've always loved. Huxley was a meditator. I don't know if you know that. He meditated in the Vedanta style in Hollywood in the 40s with other writers, Christopher Isherwood and some other people. And Shirley and I have a friend, Vijali, who I used to meditate with them in the 40s when she was a teenager. And Huxley said he found it sad to have lived a whole life and at the end of the life only be able to say, try to be a little kinder. He found that sad. And I was surprised to read that, because I think he was staring at a treasure and had no idea what it was. Which really surprised me about Huxley, who had so much great vision. And you know, to counteract it, you know, the Dalai Lama said that kindness is his religion. Mm-hmm. That's his whole religion, is kindness. And I have to say, I'd like to speak a little personally, that I've now, you know, I've reached a place where now I've stepped with both feet into what the world of Buddhism calls old age, sickness, and death. I'm in there with both feet now. And one of the great benefits of no longer reading those words, but actually looking at myself and saying, yeah, I'm in the place of old age, sickness, and death. It's me and it's all around me. Is I've had this sort of pretty profound kind of meditation on kindness. It's brought it up in me. I've always been a kind person, but now this is different. It's a very deep meditation, a very deep wanting to understand this as if it's the thing that I most need and want in order to live the life that I have left in me exactly as I want to live it. And so I've been contemplating it. It's like old age, sickness, and death in my particular form said to me, "Hey, buddy, you're getting older, and your friends are getting older, and you've had a serious illness, and your friends have had or are dealing with serious illnesses." And your friends are dying, and you're going to die too, a lot sooner than later. You got a lot more life behind you than you got in front of you in terms of years, so listen up. Here's something I want you to remember. I listened and it said, don't forget your keys. And the keys our practice and kindness for me. Speaking personally, the key is our practice and kindness, or I might say that the practice of kindness. You know, the contemplation and the practice and the attempt to live in a way that allows a kind heart to flourish and be of some use to the world. I heard a woman talking on the radio recently, and it really struck me what she said. She said, I have made a determination to befriend everyone I meet. I thought, wow, what a thing to think. I am going to befriend everyone I meet, no matter who they are. She said, without exception. And I may not get to know them, but I will consider them a friend. And sometimes friends bring you things you like, and sometimes they bring you things you don't like. She said, but I will not pretend they are not my friend. Or that I am not their friend, is how she put it. I thought that really was, that was so inspiring to hear. And I think that if, when I was preparing this talk, I looked at, looking at a kindness and looking at a kind heart as deeply as I could. And I realized that, that gratitude is part of a kind heart. And that the practice of kindness is a kind of gratitude practice. It's hard, I think, to be really grateful and not be kind. If you feel grateful and kindness hasn't moved into your heart yet, the gratitude needs to go a little more deeply in us, I think. You know, I said it before, but... you know, so please forgive me for this, but quite by surprise, the doctor said to me 2 years ago, the news is not good, you have lung cancer, often a fatal disease. And I went home, I told Shirley what the doctor told me, by surprise, it was a surprise. And then I went to sleep. And then the very next morning, the very first thought in my mind, the first thought as I woke up, was a kind of prayer. And it was, I'm so grateful for this life exactly as it is. May my life be of some benefit and bring some goodness into the world. That's exactly what went through my mind. I say it every morning when I wake up and every night when I go to sleep. So my response, and when I said exactly as it is, I included the cancer, right? And I didn't know where this was going, you know, because the guy just told me you have lung cancer. It's often fatal. Okay, we're going to find out something about it. My response naturally was just, I'm so grateful for my life, even including the cancer. I didn't want to divide myself. I needed to be kind to myself. I couldn't hate part of myself. So I had to include everything. And it just came, you know, quite naturally. And I think that it was a kind of kindness that was given to me from the deepest part of myself. Because gratitude for my life meant kindness to my life, including, you know, the disease and also the world, you know, completely. And I am certain that practice helped that thought be my first thought. I'm quite certain about it. That it found a way to help me, to be kind to me in a moment where it would be absolutely reasonable to freak out. My practice of hearing my mind in Zazen helped me hear the gratitude. It's another one of the collateral benefits of becoming very intimate with our own minds. And, you know, of course, I'm not saying that this was, you know, in any way special, you know, to me. I think that it just, you know, this is just what we are, basically. It may be difficult for us to believe that that's what we are. If we look honestly at ourselves and we look at the world around us, we see so much unkindness. But I have no question that it is a benevolent part of what it means to be a human Buddha, to be a human being. I have no question that it's inborn in every person. And we look at the world, we see all the kind of things that are going on, and it may sound absolutely, I admit it, I'm willing to be, I accept the accusation of being unbelievably naive about this. But my conviction is unshakable. All you have to do is notice how hurt you feel when you hear about something unkind that happened, or something cruel, or something worse. And you'll know that those things are against our nature. We don't have to check our value system. They're body blows. They just hurt. Because it's not our nature. It's opposed to our nature. It's opposed to what we are. We feel the pain of it, and we feel the pain of others when we hear about someone who's been treated unkindly, or a child has been bullied, or has some awful racial or torment, gender torment. You hear that? No one has to tell you, what do you think about that? Everything in us just says, no. It just hurts, because it's not who we are. And that's what my conviction is based on. And very helpfully, usefully, Candace brought up the idea, well, what about people who are sociopathic, or what about people who are, you know, are lacking that kind of empathetic expression in their lives? And all you're doing is you're looking at someone who's been hurt so badly that they are completely out of touch with their nature. That's all you're seeing. You can call it evil, but I call it suffering. And the Dharma calls it suffering. And the inability to see it is part of the suffering. It's part of our ignorance. And the inability to, or even the desire to not see it in others when they're suffering that deeply, is a sure sign that we have some work that we should do. Because that person is hurt, even if they're spreading all their hurt around. It's our job to see them for what they are. And that's part of the functioning of a kind heart. Either self and other are not other from each other, or they are. The Buddha Dharma says they are not. They are not other from each other. So this is part of where our bodhisattva away comes from. It comes from our nature and practice. And practice of a kind heart. Looking with a kind heart, at our deeds, at our thoughts, at our lives, at the lives and actions of others. Having that kind of practice with a calm, clear mind as much as possible helps this bodhisattva way, which includes the precepts and vows, to rise naturally through our being. We don't, in my view, we don't have to try to be bodhisattvas. We are born with the seed of the bodhisattva in us. And so it's important for us to know that the seed is there. Our practice nourishes the seed. It nurtures the seed. And because it's there, we have to find a way to use the fan from that first talk. Right? Find a way to actualize it in the world. Keep it warm. Keep that wind moving. And that's our practice. And that's the realization that that practice is based on and expresses. That's my view. And I believe that that's a good part of what Suzuki Roshi was encouraging in us in his talks as presented the last 2 days. So, I thank you. I had more for you, but there's no time. Four vows.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Dharma gates are boundless.